Next, let me introduce to you Jonathan Zittrain. What can I tell you about Jonathan? Well, to start, he's a co-founder and executive director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at the Harvard Law School. The center contributes to the shaping of the internet by conducting dialogues on development, through those affecting the internet, change, and growth. A process he calls self-active study. As you'll soon discover, he'll give you the big picture, and then he'll zoom in on precise, practical insights. He's no stranger to this town, having served with the State Department, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, and the Justice Department. Among his responsibilities, he has worked 14 years as an online administrator for CompuServe. Lawyer, scientist, master teacher, and moderator, I'm honored to present Jonathan Zittrain.
Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning. It's true, I come back to D.C. as a visitor today, and perhaps if any of you was really into information technology, I could deliver the charge of developing a software platform that will make something other than indeterminate the price of a taxi cab ride from National Airport into downtown. I sit there and I have the entire ride to actually work out how much I think it's going to be, and yet I'm always surprised, and not each time pleasantly, I might say. So I'm going to try to give the big picture a little bit today, and in doing so, highlight some of the sessions that you may be going to experiencing over today and the next day as well. I want to share some of the things we've been studying at Harvard Law School, which you might think an unlikely place to be studying the internet, but we are getting into it just as everyone else is. And in particular, I want to ask the question, what's different about .gov? You see, I've been working a lot on domain name issues recently. Ira Magaziner, who follows me today, has been, or at least had been, hard at work on such things, and has actually done a terrific job trying to keep the domain name system as we know it intact, stable, and actually privatized. That has proven to be quite a difficult task, but just as when one studies a foreign language, one ends up dreaming in that language, I've started dreaming in dots. So I decided to frame some remarks today in terms of dots. And again, it's to ask the question, what is distinct about being somebody who is associated with .gov? What might be drawn from the other top-level domains, such as they are, in order to make .gov as good as it can be? Because my instinct tells me that .gov isn't yet realizing its full potential. In this space right now, .com is the sort of gold-plated or even platinum name, and there are many, again, lessons to be drawn. Now, of course, as I speak, I think you may be trying to think, run through your minds, what are the other top-level domains? If there's at least one thing you'll draw from this talk, it is all of the generic top-level domains, but if you can get the last two before I can get them, you are truly an internet maven. So first, what are the general trends we see? Well, the general trends we see are, first, people trying to look at the internet as a virtual partner, a kind of seamless web, not just a World Wide Web, but something that if they have a question, they want to go to the web and get an answer to the question. They don't want to have to fuss around with search engines and protocols and knowing exactly what particular website to go to. It may be that the internet that we see in the next 2 or 3 years is one that converges to a far easier to use, an appliance that's just kind of in hand. Dick Tracy may not be talking to somebody else on his wrist TV, but simply giving an order into the net, be it for a pizza or for some prime piece of information that he needs. Another question is whether we're going to have essentially one net from the user's perspective or many communities. To what extent, when you surf the internet, is it going to be pretty much like watching television? A kind of consistent experience. Yes, there's one channel, there's another channel, but still settling into a fairly consistent pattern of what to expect, no matter how many channels you might find on your cable box. Or might it be otherwise? Might it be a whole different set of communities with very different feels among them as you go from one place to another? And if it is the latter, again, I say, is there something distinct about .gov, that when one is visiting a .gov area rather than somewhere else, there's a distinct feeling that one might get and a distinct way of interacting with the site. I do have some ideas on that, which by the end of my remarks, you will know. So first, let's just look at some of the other areas of the net, going by the dots and try to connect them up. First, we have .com, the commercial domain. And again, I say that that's the domain that has most recently seized the most there is to seize of the internet. Many of the elements of growth we see are coming from an explosion in .com sites and in the business that they conduct and the services they offer. They've been leading, I suppose, for no surprising reason that entrepreneurship is the hallmark of the commercial world. It's the commercial world that's going to end up taking risks, going out there, trying new things, perhaps things that haven't been proven before. And one question to ask would be, if you're .gov, to what extent can you be taking risks as well? Now, I don't think there's an easy answer to that question, because the nature of the services your agency might render or the work that you're involved in could be such that if you take a risk, and as sometimes happens with risks, you lose, there's either plenty of recriminations to go around. I suppose if anybody is here from the Social Security Administration, they can speak to the terrific website that came up with the intention of allowing people to check their benefits online, and suddenly it spun into a huge privacy debate. People worried about others being able to find out what their benefits were. Now, whether or not those concerns were real, there was certainly a risk that that could happen, and it materialized a little bit, and the Social Security Administration had to regroup and pick up the pieces and show that what it was doing was entrepreneurial. It was going where no agency maybe had gone before. And again, there can come great reward with that, but great risks. So one question would be, to what extent can you instigate things that haven't been particularly provable yet in their success, that maybe you could frame as a pilot program, something simply to try with just a few customers or just a few clients and see how well it can work, document it, expose it to the kind of people that for whatever reason may feel vulnerable to it or worried about it, get them into the process, and then proceed from there, from the pilot program into the larger system if need be. Another feature of .com is that it's using the latest technology. I mean, it's .com both on the back end, experimenting with new computers and servers and operating systems, and on the front end, new ways of interacting with people, new drop-down boxes, what have you. To what extent can .gov be part of that too? Well, again, if you're running a government application that people have come to rely on, stability may be the hallmark, which means it's got to work, it's got to be robust. As Don said, it's got to be up 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Perhaps that then constrains the amount of experimentation that can be done. The other thing is that from the point of view of somebody surfing, these extra features that you might be inclined to put in may be ones that if you're running web TV, if you're running Netscape or Internet Explorer version 1, you can't exactly enjoy, or may even break the browser. Now, we know the Workforce Investment Act, recently the President's Commission that had been chartered by that act came back, and has come up with a whole number of ways that websites that are federal government websites or ones of companies that contract with federal government need to be fully accessible to the disabled. Now, this has an interesting feature. First, it means it constrains somewhat, perhaps, what you can do as far as being creative with your websites. The second thing it means is that if you're going to try to be creative, you've got to bring everybody along. So maybe it means you have to have two views, one for those who are fully web-enabled and one for those who are not, with each view being able to offer the same services at the bottom line as each other. Now, I suppose this is actually an opportunity for risk-taking. I mean, right now, pushed into it, and perhaps nobly so, by something like the Workforce Investment Act, it's now up to the federal government to show that it can offer websites that are as open to the disabled as they are to everyone else in a way that commercial websites are simply not required to do. Now, commercial websites, in certain instances, may find it to their benefit to have such sites. You can run the numbers and just figure out, perhaps more determinedly than with a taxi cab, is it to our benefit to have different views of the website, to invest in that and thereby to bring in more customers. For the federal government, there's no cost benefit. You simply are going to have to do it. And again, I say that might be an opportunity for investment, an opportunity to actually go where .com has not yet gone, to show that there's a possibility of offering services equally across the board while still being able to invoke features that are from the latest versions of the web and the internet as we know it. And of course, a third element of .com from which we might draw is that of balancing the books. I mean, the ultimate way, even though we seem to be in a stratospheric environment where if any commercial enterprise appears to be internet-related, it is wildly funded to the tune of billions of dollars. If only, of course, our own enterprises could be phrased as internet enterprises and then put out for initial public offerings. But it's limited to .com to be able to do such things. They then have, at some point, you think, to pay the piper. You've got to have an idea that actually hits pay dirt and then results in a return for your business. Now, of course, in the federal government and in other government service-oriented agencies, there's also a concern about money. You've got to get the most bang for your buck that you can, particularly in times when you have a consuming public that expects to get a lot of bang for the buck. And exactly how to do that, there may well be things to borrow from the commercial sector that don't necessarily entail simply maximizing profit, but at least minimizing expense. Concepts like total cost of ownership are elements that work just as well in the public sector as they might in the private. And I see there are several seminars on that subject later today and tomorrow. I know recently I actually was inquiring about getting a passport, and I found there were two ways I could inquire. I could call an 800 number and wait on hold for a while and get my information, or I could call a 1-900 number run by the U.S. Department of State and immediately get somebody, and for $4.95 or so, get the answer to my question and be on my way. Now, that's actually a segmenting of services in a way that is to the truest of aspirations of the private sector that, again, the public sector is using. And of course, as you decide whether or not or how to adopt such practices, it raises wonderful questions that really require some thought as to how government shall offer services, how it should recover the costs for doing so, and on what basis and to how many people they should be offered. Okay, apart from .com, we have .org. What do we learn from .org? Well, .org, of course, was meant originally for nonprofit organizations, UNICEF.org, perhaps, or CommonCause.org. Now, when people surf, there is some sense when they hit a .org site of different expectation. How does the expectation differ? Well, when you're on a .org site, for one thing, perhaps, you don't expect it to be as glitzy. You don't expect it to be completely all there the way you do a .com site. After all, when you're visiting a .com site, you're often visiting as a consumer, as somebody that's expecting to buy something, to be sold something. You want to be told why you should be there. You want to be sold something in a way that gives you confidence in the seller and that realizes that you can just as easily take your business elsewhere. .org has a little bit more of a sense of we're all in this together. This is a nonprofit organization. So you should cut them a break if their HTML skills are perhaps a little bit less than you might find on other sites. Now, of course, to be sure, not every .org site is amateur in the way I've described. But again, the expectations when you visit them may well be different. And that leads me to ask, what are the expectations that our citizens have when they visit a .gov site? Do they visit it in the mode of consumer, expecting to get bang for a buck? Do they visit it in the mode of a possible member of a nonprofit organization, wanting to visit something in which they feel a partial ownership? They actually feel a part of the Department of State or the Department of Commerce. They feel related to it in a way that it speaks for them, not necessarily the way a particular commercial site might speak to them. Also, .org harkens back to the era of the old internet. What's the old internet as we remember it? Well, you may have heard of my introduction. I worked for 14 years and still do as a system administrator on CompuServe. I originally started out in the Texas Instruments Forum. I think I was about 12. And my parents actually, I talked to them enough. They eventually took me out to JCPenney, spent $200, and I got one of those TI-99 4A computers. I don't know how many MIPS it could handle. It had, I think 32K of RAM. I guess my current computer has 128 megs, which is 128,000K of RAM. You know, doing the math again can be confusing. But in any case, this thing was just slightly above a calculator, although it did hook up to your television set, had a wonderful screen, and I soon got a modem for it, operating, of course, with a wonderful clip of 300 baud, which had the advantage of you could actually read the data as it scrolled across the screen. And this was the era, of course, when you look at just how lazy we've become with graphics. The single picture of a waving American flag on a government website, of course, would take my old PI several hours to download, with commensurately less satisfaction once it was done. So as a result, you had to be very economical with your words. You'd actually be typing at other people, perhaps in real time, or perhaps posting messages on a given subject, and you wouldn't make the message longer than it had to be, because after all, it would actually cost people time and money, they were paying by the hour, to actually download the message. So I actually found myself on the TI-99/4A forum, and was just amazed. There were other people across the nation, and soon across the world, that happened to have the same computer I did. We could talk about different tips and tricks. Now, my approach to this was not as a consumer, nor anybody else in the forum. We went in, we're so thrilled to just meet other people and be sharing these tips. I found I got as much satisfaction when I could answer a question of a new person that, of course, had been answered for me 6 months prior. I got more satisfaction from that than I did in getting an answer to a question I had had. Sort of a wonderful way of sharing information for which CompuServe merely set up the tent. We gathered under the tent and proceeded to have discussions among us, all as members. Of course, this worked for about 2 months until several hundred dollars worth of bills came in on my parents' credit card, and they told me I either had to take up a paper route or quit the internet business. I went on, sadly told my friends online that I could no longer afford CompuServe, and was offered a chance to sysop, to be a system operator, in exchange for free time on the service. This meant doing what I had already been doing, just more, and for free, which seemed a perfectly good deal to me. And in fact, to this day, it still does. Of course, the TI forum is no longer around. I'm sad to say that the TI-99/8 was not a big success. And as a result, TI got out of the computer business, at least the little PC home computer business. So I ended up a sysop of the sysop forum. There's actually one forum where the sysops of each of the forums, the wine forum and the computer forums and the horse forum and the religion forum, they all gather in their own forum called the sysop forum and talk about how to run forums. And occasionally they get into fights and arguments, and somebody has to come in and help settle that. Now, that's an environment, again, that to this day remains one of sharing. You'll see it sometimes on the web in its best counterpart of DejaNews.com or other areas of what's called Usenet. Public messaging areas where people download messages from other people that may contain questions or comments on a given subject and then can give replies. To me, this is really .org in one of its best senses, even though for me it started on CompuServe.com. And I would ask, is there any way in which .gov should become a tent of that sort? Is there any way, as you imagine developing the next generation website for your agency or department, that you could see actually having it be a tent? The traditional customer service model is people call in, they dial the 1-800 number or the 1-900 number, they speak to a counselor who gives information, and the transaction is over. What if those questions and answers, depending on the task, of course, were themselves publicly available, and you could actually go through as a fellow citizen and see some of the questions and answers that there had been? Now, of course, you may be thinking there's all sorts of reasons why this is a complicated proposition. There are privacy concerns. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily want people putting their consumer complaints to the Federal Trade Commission into a public database where their own name and number could be found and where a company might be besmirched unfairly until the complaint had been investigated. But there are other applications where you could actually imagine a great dialogue taking place, one where customer service in some sense can take care of itself as people interact with each other as much as they interact with the agency. And then, of course, you have the wrinkle of, what do you do when somebody signs on and becomes as helpful a question answerer as they were an asker before and just happens to consistently give the wrong answer? There is a number of pieces of advice I remember from the TI-99 days for which it was just completely, perfectly wrong. And how to deal with that is a great question, too. But again, at least I pose the issue of, is there a way in which you could imagine .gov being an umbrella for many-to-many communication around the subjects that are uniquely that of government? At least you could imagine, say, on Capitol Hill, a congressman, a senator, wanting to allow constituents to meet and talk to each other on that person's website, on the senator's website, rather than simply sending in a form email, I'm outraged about the following three bills, and in it goes. So imagine a community of people growing up around your website as a congressman or a senator, not only perhaps bespeaks well of public service and a public function, but also might make sense in getting customer loyalty around election time. So that's .org. What about .edu? At the moment, I'm coming from .edu. Where do we come from? Well, for one thing, I suppose, in its best way, the realm of education, of higher education, is to spread knowledge and to do it in a way that doesn't necessarily count the pennies as they come in. Of course, .edu is learning from .com as much as .gov may be, so that, too, is changing. Most of the ways in which you see educational institutions coming onto the Internet is actually as a for-profit adjunct to what might otherwise be nonprofit activities. Distance learning, for example, is a for-profit field for the most part, where you'll have universities come up. For instance, Duke now offers an MBA online, but they charge, of course, even more than their usual tuition in relation to the amount it costs them to offer it as a way of supporting their on-campus programs. Now, we at the Berkman Center are trying to ask ourselves, how might you offer education and knowledge in a way that isn't necessarily tied to only making it available to those who can pay for it? And we've offered a series of free lectures and discussions over the Internet on a number of public subjects open to anybody who would care to sign up for them. And to our interest, there have actually been companies and people who have stepped forward after the series and said, boy, that was so good, can I write you a check, please? And of course, it would be crazy to say no. And as a result, I've actually gone some way in funding our own offerings through people who, on the back end, after they've experienced it, have decided that they like it. What else do we know from .edu? Well, first we know that the net is a research tool. It's a place that you can go to find out things. It's not just a place in which you operate to tell other people things. And it's the scholars of .edu who first, perhaps, thought of the net before .com arrived as an educational enterprise and one in which they might be finding out information as readily as they are divulging it. Now, there are several sessions coming up today and tomorrow that range from data mining to research tools and methods, how to actually be an agency that is finding out as much as it can and learning as much from the net as it is hoping to share there. And as you're thinking through, again, what your next generation website or integrated Internet offerings may be, figuring out how to make the Internet on the desktop within the agency a tool where you can be finding out information you need to know, information, say, about what the public at large thinks of you, about issues that you are concerned about, gathering open source data, as they say. That's a real challenge and a real growth area, and it's one for which .edu, I suppose, has tried to become the expert. Next is .net. .net was originally intended for those organizations that were the backbone of the Internet, GTE.net, even AOL.net, not just AOL.com. And I suppose there are some net-like elements to the government. For one thing, the government is an essential provider of services. We can imagine very quickly going from a world in which the World Wide Web is an optional way to go about your government business. You can go to the website and find out something, but of course you can also go in person or send in a postcard or call an 800 number to find out information. But as the World Wide Web becomes more and more convenient and more the obvious way to get to particular kinds of information for your public, they then start to rely on it. And you start staffing down the 800 numbers. And you don't need to have necessarily the Consumer Information Service in Pueblo, Colorado. Does anybody remember the Consumer Information Service in Pueblo, Colorado? They had those ads, and you could send in a postcard, and they'd send you an information pamphlet. Does anybody here run the Consumer Information Service in Pueblo, California? Aha, we have somebody here. So no doubt you're wondering about your web strategy. It's online, there you go. Exactly. So we've entered the new era. You can still get the pamphlets, and of course now you can get them online. Now it does mean that the prevalence of people doing it through the mail, as more and more people sign up on the net, is going to drop. And once that takes place, now you start realizing the net can become mission critical. Because if suddenly you pull out the rug and the net goes down, you don't have the infrastructure that you used to support doing it by postcard anymore. It's not an option to go back to that era. That starts to really sink in then that while the web today, for many applications, may be a luxury, may be something even for which people have an expectation that it won't always be up. I don't know how many people for themselves, or let's just make it say for their kids, got tickets to the Star Wars movie when they opened. How many of you got tickets or even are in possession right now of Star Wars tickets? My Lord, I see one. How many of you have it and just don't want to admit it? Okay, a number of people there. Now you can see there are different ways to get the tickets. You go stand in line at the theater, and of course there are romantic elements to standing in line at the theater. You get to suffer the elements and you know the news crews and things like that. You could also call movie phone, right? Is it 333 film here in D.C. or 666 film? There's some number you call in D.C. to get onto movie phone, or you go to the website. Now everybody knew what was going to happen. Sure enough, it did. I know that the movie phone people put several more computers online, and for all I know it's a compact system, but movie phone got overwhelmed. The net got blocked, and the people that got the first tickets to the very first matinee were the ones who were in line. And again, I suggest there's going to be the era where we become so reliant, because it is so convenient, on the internet to conduct our business, that it won't be an option to have it go down on Mother's Day or on Star Wars Ticket Day or some other occasion that we now sort of find it quaint, Ken Star Report Day, to become particularly clogged or go down. So that's one way in which we see Gov as net. It's actually a backbone. It's something upon which people are relying for essential services they can't get anywhere else and for which they do expect it to be up 365 days a year, 7 days a week, etc. There's also one other way in which we could imagine .gov as a truly a network provider, and that is with yet another domain, the .us domain. The .us domain is currently in limbo. There's no government agency that actually runs it, even though it is the designated country code for the United States of America online. A great fellow named John Postel held it in trust for many years for the U.S. government and was the person that a local municipality, if they wanted something like Cambridge.massachusetts.state.us, they'd call up John on the phone out in California and say, John, can I have Cambridge? I'm the mayor of Cambridge. He'd say, no, I'm sorry, the city council already has it. You'll have to work it out with them. I understand the Postal Service has had interest in taking up .us. Now, that actually makes a lot of sense. I mean, the Postal Service, for one thing, has trust. It's an agency that even by law has more strictures on the release of public information than commercial counterparts. And it's an agency that runs one of the most massive databases in the world. I mean, when you forward your own mail to a different address because you've moved and those yellow stickers end up perfectly on each envelope, I mean, think of the marvel of technology that that represents, that your mail can be so efficiently rerouted. So similarly, we may find the government, or the quasi-government in the case of the USPS, in the business actually of offering network services to people through the .us domain. It's another area in which you could say people could turn to the government as a place to get a reliable email account, a reliable mail forwarding account. In fact, the idea I had given to the Postal Service was, wouldn't it be great if you could take an envelope and write somebody's email address on it and drop it in a blue post box and have it get to them? I mean, why not? There's only one email address. I mean, there's only one person for every email address. So why shouldn't you be able to write their email address, put it in the box, and then it gets to them wherever they may be? Indeed, it actually gives you sort of a virtual locator, so you don't have to use the yellow stickies anymore. When you move, you just forward your email address to your new physical address. I understand they've taken it under advisement, but if it happens, you heard it here first, and it was my idea, darn it, I want credit. So next is .mil, the military. And of course, the military is with the government. We are one family and a number of people from the military, be it civilian or straight DOD, with us today. To me, what does the military represent? It represents security and stability. It was notable to me that when a particular foreign government was very displeased at something the United States had done recently, they no doubt tried to take it out on any number of U.S. government websites. The ones they actually landed upon were, I believe, the Park Service, the Interior Department. Everybody here had their website recently under some form of, dare I say, information warfare, some kind of attack by entities of a foreign government, or at least a foreign country. But it makes you realize first that the military might have something they could share on the issues of security and stability, but it also makes us realize that even if you're the Park Service, you have reason to be concerned about stability and security. That your kind of disclaimer that your jurisdictional boundaries don't happen to reach across the Pacific Ocean does not necessarily mean that you will be spared if somebody decides to make a point on your site. And again, there's a number of sessions I see later today and tomorrow on security and stability, which may then be of interest, regardless of how you feel your agency may fit into the geopolitical framework, or how it might. Does anybody remember? There are two more generic top-level domains. Anybody know them? Well, one more, .int, meant for international treaty organizations, a website of some familiarity now is NATO.int, which has gotten both a lot of visits recently and come under a number of cyber attacks. To me, int bespeaks international. And surely, what are the borders in cyberspace? We know that things are just a click away, more or less, no matter where you are. And as a result, you realize that your audience is truly global. That then forces those of us within .gov to ask the question, who is our audience? Who should we be catering to? Should our website only be in English? Now, of course, agencies like the U.S. Information Agency, who have a specific charge of reaching out to other countries around the world, have glommed on to this. If you go to the site, they've got different languages. They've got many of the programs that they do in the real world, in the physical world. They've got counterparts on their website. But then you also may ask within your own site, is it worth tracking the kinds of visits we're getting? What portion of the visits we get are from U.S. based sites, so far as we can tell, and what portion is from overseas? How do we cater to truly an international audience and distinguish between different groups that may have different interests in the information that we offer? That's a very good question. We also may ask, perhaps could our site be truly an example to the world? I mean, what better way to show the democracy that the United States is in action by being able to show the world that each ministry, each department, each unit has a public space shown to the world, accessible to the world, one where you can see the services it offers, the data that it's providing, and then people can look to their own countries and you actually then have a bit of competition, can actually see, wow, the state seems to do it this way. I wish my country could do the same. And of course, it says the opposite to us. There may be a lot we can learn just from our desktops surfing to the sites of other governments and other government agencies outside the United States to learn how they are implementing things and adopting things and how we might stack up next to that. A final domain name. This is the one that there's no way you'd guess if you didn't know it. It's .ARPA. .ARPA was grandfathered in, the Advanced Research Projects Agency. It had its own namespace. It was competing for the dots. And when the dots won out, .ARPA kind of got swallowed whole. And all the old ARPA names were put to the left of .ARPA and then worked into the .dot address. So what does .ARPA tell us? Well, one thing .ARPA tells us, as Don reminded us as well this morning, was that the Internet originally came from the government. It wasn't commercial investment that got this thing going. The National Science Foundation and the military providing money and support to actually internetwork people. Now, that actually makes sense because, as we know, the value of a network increases exponentially as you add more people to it, which the converse is, the value of a network that's very small is not very much at all. So you have to go, it's kind of the Federal Express problem, you have to go from nobody on your initial network to pretty much everyone on it, or at least available to it, for it to really have value. And it's government that's in the perfect place to solve the problem of the commons and provide a network with enough people on it that it can then gather its own steam and provide the open door through which .com has entered and now has provided private investments to move the net forward and to keep the growth going that we've seen charted this morning. So we have a fine tradition of the government having been behind, having formed the internet. What else? The government gave it away. Now, I don't say this the way you might say, what? You gave away this precious resource? For one thing, in a network economy, to give away the net, to get more people onto it, is to increase its value for everyone. So it's a wonderful way to give something away and then immediately have it come back in terms of extra value of the network. This was discovered later by .com when Netscape got the idea of giving their browser away as a way of increasing the value of the browser. The U.S. government was actually light years ahead of Netscape with that strategy. But there's another way in which we think of giving away and sharing. We know that the U.S. government can't copyright its own works. By law, the U.S. government is to give away that which it creates. It's in the public domain. It's for everyone to share. It's part of the innate mission of pretty much every government agency to be able to share its results, what it has. Of course, many of you still may be familiar with FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act, which of course has its own ups and downs. I remember, perhaps the story is apocryphal, but it was a story of a woman who was a professional FOIA-er, and she would FOIA things by running into government agencies, sort of vaulting over desks, and then she would grab onto a file cabinet and hug it and say, I FOIA this. And in the meantime, she'd be hauled away, charged with trespass, but in fact, she had at least identified a system of records adequate to satisfy the statute, and the FOIA request was lodged, and she could wait for the government to reply with whatever objections it might have. Otherwise, the records in that file cabinet might be deemed duly FOIA'd. In fact, I think she tried to do the same trick with something known as the DIF formula, the DIF formula being that formula that the IRS uses at times to know whether or not to audit a tax return. You simply apply a certain multiplier to each entry in the return. You sum them. It's as complicated as figuring out DC taxi fare. But by the time you're done, it gives you a number as to what likelihood there is that the return is deserving of an audit. So she FOIA'd the DIF formula, which, of course, if you knew, would help you architect the perfect tax return. While wholly fraudulent, it would sail right through the DIF. You'll be happy to know that the IRS was able to prevail on a defense of national security not to release the DIF formula. All of this is to say that we are in an environment in .gov of sharing. Whether we like it or not, I think there's good reason to like it. I don't know how many of you have labored under the dictates of a case known as Armstrong v. United States. This is the case by which moments before Ronald Reagan left office, FOIA requests were lodged for all of the email in the White House. And hard drives had to be removed from the computers by order of a federal judge while the case was argued. They were taken down to the National Archives, called a big wheelbarrow going down Pennsylvania Ave with these hard drives, put in a room. The case, of course, is still ongoing. But the question is email a federal record? And a key element to figuring out whether email is a federal record, it turned out, was when you print out an email, is the printout the same as the email was? Because if, in fact, it was, then it would be sufficient for a government agency to have a standing policy that says, whenever you have an email that turns out to rise to the level of a federal record, it's substantive enough, it's federal recordish enough to be one, print it out and then file it the way you would any piece of paper. If you had that policy, you wouldn't have to worry about email being federal records because you'd either have non-records or duplicates as people printed out their email. But the way the all-in-one system worked in the White House, when you printed out an email, it didn't capture all of the information that you could get if you looked at the email. The email, it turned out, had who received it and when with a timestamp on it, which has overtones of what did you know and when do you know it, kind of information that you'd be very interested in knowing if you were somehow FOIAing lots of things. Now, the lesson from that to me is that the code, the structure of the software you're using in the agency is itself dictating the nature of your federal records. Whether or not, in fact, that printout is a federal record, which means whether or not, in fact, the email is a federal record, is a function of the all-in-one software. If you're the White House and you're going through the next round of software procurement or development, and you say, by the way, you know that who did you get and when did they get it thing? We don't need that feature. Let's just get rid of that. You would actually be changing whether or not the email was a federal record. So this highlights first the caveat that the decisions you make on technology actually can have interesting policy implications, say with FOIA, but also the idea that the software just generally matters. And one thing I was very pleased to see in the program later today and tomorrow is that there are a variety of operating systems and platforms offered here that you can learn about so that you're not just sold one particular platform. There may be differences between Windows NT and Unix that may bear on which way you're going to go in your own agency. Indeed, what if, as an agency, not just you were just not thinking of sharing information, you were thinking of sharing your code? What would it mean if your actual software that you develop, you were to put out onto the web itself to be shared? Now, of course, your first instinct may be, oh, that would be a wonderful security breach. And indeed, maybe it would. Although, of course, those who rely on the secrecy of their software as an element of security may be the ones that are somewhat naive. The other question might be, to what extent could the software you're developing serve as an example and inspiration and even running code for others? Here we are. Again, we talked about renovating websites and changing them so that they're accessible to the disabled. The federal government is now taking the lead on this. What if the tools developed to build those websites were released to the general public so that others, .org, .edu, even .com, could draw from those tools and suddenly be learning from the federal government and taking them and building their own sites accessible to the disabled thanks to the hard work and money put in by people in .gov. I don't know if that's a celebratory reaction to that idea, but it's at least a thought. Why shouldn't we be thinking of sharing our code as readily as we may be sharing our information? And of course, sharing need not just go between the government and the public. It can go among government agencies. To what extent could you avoid reinventing the wheel in your particular department if there's some other wheel that's been well invented by another department? How could you facilitate either a database or a commons, some tent under which all of you could go to figure out who has already done what in a given area and from whom you could borrow to do it yourself? The Department of Commerce may already have a great web lookup function built in with their telephone database, so you can type in the name of the employee and boom, in an instant, get that person's phone number and address. If your agency doesn't have it yet, well, I wonder if Commerce share theirs. I don't know. I don't mean to suggest that they would necessarily. I suppose it has the ancillary benefit, too, of if your particular piece of your database crashes, you can always blame NASA. We got it from them. It's not our fault. But it does suggest an interoperability among government agencies that is not top-down. There's not one information IT czar at the top saying all of the agencies are going to use this particular software. But, it's still interoperable. It's saying you can have one agency share its results with another, and in a way, the best applications may become the most popular, and the agencies are able to pull them all selves together up with the best applications. That would be a wonderful thing to be able to do. And depending on whether you're on a Linux operating system or a Microsoft one, there may be different factors as to how readily you can share these modules. So what is .gov? .gov is a public trust. It is something that has really a tougher job than .com. You've got no easy competition. Nobody actually nipping directly at the heels at times for which you can say, wow, that's a great idea, we should do that. In many instances, you're left to your own devices to figure out what the next and most innovative steps are, except to the extent that you might be looking to other governments to see what they are doing. It's a tougher job then than .com. It's something that's expecting a greater public trust. There's a certain reliance, a certain expectation that is reminiscent of .org. People visiting a government website want to feel that it's their home, that it's a part of them. As much as people are out there saying, ah, government, or government somehow is at times not popular with people. Those very people who find it not popular, when they call 911, they're calling the government for help. When they call the State Department Citizens Emergency Center, they're calling the government for help. It's the same people that say, ah, Congress, throw the bums out, but not my bum. I want to reelect my bum. Similarly, while there may be some level of general skittishness about government, when it comes down to it, on a particular thing that's needed, the public has great trust in government, great reliance in it, and even a great identity with it, a desire to see it reflect their values and to be able to draw their own values from it. From .edu, we know that sometimes it's the only source of information, and that information sharing should be critical to what most agencies are up to. Information both introspectively about what they're doing and how they're doing it, the sort of thing for which FOIA was intended, to be able to share that over the web would be amazing, and information about their particular operations. If you're the Park Service, where to find the parks. If you're the Information Service in Pueblo, Colorado, the particular pieces of consumer information that you steward as a public trust and share with the public in a way that is unbiased and the public knows that they can count on. And finally, the spotlight is upon the government in a way that it isn't on any given individual company. Expectations are strong. People expect the government to do good and do well, and when it doesn't, they howl. It may not be fair, but it's the fact. And to be able to live up to those expectations is quite a challenge. And from that, we know the government is, in a sense, backbone. It's something upon which people are relying, expecting, and again, would have to be up 365 days a year, 7 days a week. So with that, I want to turn it over to the rest of the day. Thank you all. I'll be around afterwards and be delighted to talk. And may I wish you all well as you rise to the new realm, the new domain of .gov. Thank you.